This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, welcome back to the second hour. Jim, I hope you enjoyed your time off, but we do have a lot of ground to cover today. And what we're going to cover are many of the topics of this fall's Wealth Protection Conference. We're also going to discuss a topic at this year's Federal Conclave, financial concentration. And that's a topic that was on this program over the past year. So let's get right into the weeds.
All right, Chris, one of the themes of this year's conference is what is different? And what I mean by that, what is different in this business and market cycle? Because every market cycle has its own characteristics. There's different bubbles, there's different crises or different causes. What really stands out this time, and this is a theme that we've been talking about here on the program for the last 2 years, the difference this time is Trump. And what makes him different is he initiated a large tax cut, and Congress authorized over $300 billion in additional spending over the next 2 years. So basically, we have now added $2 trillion of fiscal stimulus to the economy at the end of a long business cycle. And that's one of the reasons why you're seeing this extend the life of this cycle, turning it into one of the longest running business cycles in U.S. history. Most of the tax cuts, roughly about 75% of them, went to lower corporate tax rates from 35 to 21%. So this has helped to boost corporate profits. We've seen that in the first quarter and the second quarter of this year. It's increasing corporate cash flow, and that has led to what has been a record-breaking year for corporate merger and acquisition activity, a story that I want to come back to later on.
And I know this is something you've mentioned here before, is that this stimulus is coming right in the middle of a Fed rate raising cycle. And we just simply haven't seen this before. So what impact is this going to have on the markets and the economy?
Well, the last president who began his term and ended it with the Fed rate raising cycle was George H. Bush. Greenspan began to raise interest rates during the 90 and 91 period. It led to a recession right in the middle of an election year. And so the only difference was George H. Bush did not have a tax cut or, in fact, the very famous thing, read my lips, he actually raised taxes. So what makes this unusual is typically you get, Chris, fiscal policy and monetary policy working together as we did, for example, under George W. Bush when we were coming out of a recession and with President Barack Obama in 2009 when we were working our way out of a recession. This time, we're in a recovery, and it's towards the end of that recovery, we're getting this picture of huge stimulus, and I'm talking massive stimulus to the tune of almost $2 trillion. It just wasn't the tax cuts. Then Congress came in and added $300 billion of additional spending. So it's no wonder that the economy is growing at 4%. Eventually, however, there is going to be a high probability that the Fed rate hikes will bring an end to this business cycle, as they always do. What stimulus has done, and this is just a personal opinion, it's allowed the Fed to raise and hike rates more often. Instead of once a year, which was the case in 2015 and 2016, when the Fed began to raise rates, the Fed has now gone to 3, and this year possibly 4 rate hikes. So without the stimulus, in my opinion, there's no way the Fed would have gotten this far. But right now, the stimulus is strong enough to keep this market and economy going well into next year.
Now, Jim, our first show in August, you predicted no recession or bear market this year, and even possibly till the end of next year. I believe you even mentioned that almost $500 billion in stimulus is pouring into the economy next year. So no bear market or recession, at least this year, possibly even next year. So outside the stimulus and Fed cycle, you've identified three particular aspects about this bull market that make it different. The first one is an index bubble. The second is financial concentration, and third, liquidity crisis. And these topics and more will be covered at this fall's Wealth Protection Conference. So let's touch on each theme. Financial concentration was the subject of the Fed's August conclave. Recently, J.P. Morgan's top quant echoed of the theme we touched on in late spring, which is the liquidity crisis that will unfold in the next downturn. So you're not the only one that's talking about this issue. There are others that see the same risk issue.
Let's begin with the first issue, which is passive index bubble. Today, if you look at the equity market, there's about $3.5 trillion of index mutual funds that are managed passively. In addition to the mutual funds is the massive amount of money that has gone into ETFs, most of which are passively managed. Now, this massive move into passive investing is having two effects on the markets. Let's talk about them. One, it's distorting valuations. Number two, it's reducing the ability of the market to recover from large drawdowns by reducing liquidity. If you are, in essence, the market, then who do you sell to? Who comes in and buys? So you don't have managers that are in there to buy value when markets go to extremes on the downside. If you add up the nearly $4 trillion in mutual funds and the $5 trillion in ETF assets, most of which are passively managed, index funds now represent nearly 45% of assets under management globally. Now, when they sell, once again, this is a question I've raised with many of the experts here on the program, and nobody has a good answer. Who are they going to sell to? So if you have these market distortions that we have in terms of markets and real internals, I want to give you some examples of this, and it'll kind of illustrate what I'm talking about. Now, let's take Amazon, which this week, for a brief moment, became the second company in history to approach a $1 trillion market cap. They only did it for a brief moment. It was only for a day. Amazon is a great company. Don't get me wrong. I guess the question is it worth $1 trillion? Now, let me give you an example. We take Amazon, which is worth about $950 billion. Their sales are a little over $200 billion a year, a pretty sizable company. They're the second largest retailer in the United States. But let's take a look at Amazon's competitors. Let's take Walmart. Walmart has a market cap of only $285 billion, and their sales are $510 billion. If you take Costco, Costco has a market cap a little over $100 billion, and Costco has sales of $140 billion. And then take Target, which has a market cap of $47 billion and sales of $74 billion. Another way of looking at this, the entire market cap of Walmart, Costco, and Target is $435 billion, and their sales are almost $750 billion. So if you look at that, Amazon could buy all three retail giants for less than 50% of its market value, not to mention all three companies make 3 to 4 times what Amazon makes in profits. Furthermore, the bulk of Amazon's profits come from non-related businesses. The most profitable part of Amazon is not retail, it's cloud computing. The second example, let's take one of the best performing sectors in the market this year, which is consumer discretionary stocks, the ETF XLY. The sector turned in a performance return of 18%. That was ahead of technology, clocking in at 16%, and healthcare at 12%. But John Murphy over at Stock Charts was looking at this the other day, and he analyzed the ETF on an unweighted basis, because a lot of these ETFs and index funds are based on market cap. The company that has the largest market cap makes up a larger portion of the index. So he took XLY and basically said, all right, let's unweight the index. How well did it do? Well, if you unweight consumer discretionary stocks, it's only up 7% this year. Amazon is up 70% and accounts for 25% of the XLY's returns. So you have much of the market today that is run by machines and non-thinking asset managers. I just don't see an asset manager that is sitting there and saying, you know, at 200 times earnings, Amazon is a buy. Most of the fund managers that are buying Amazon are simply passive index managers. And this was something I brought up recently with an interview that we did last month with John Rowe.
So much of the money is now being managed not by people, but by machines. So much of the volume is run in a passive fashion, not by humans. I don't know why it's happening. I will tell you, however, that I am dubious on the Russell 2000 and why that's working. So my explanation is, yes, I realize the Russell 2000 is winning. I do not believe it is winning because small caps are doing better than big caps. I believe it is winning because more money, relatively more money, has been going into the IWM ETF vis-a-vis the SPY ETF. And here's my extended reasoning. There is no way on God's green earth that any big cap manager is selling the biggest of big caps to buy small cap stocks. There is not enough small cap to go around to satisfy anybody who's managing big cap money. So I think that is a shibboleth. I think it is an old wives' tale. No offense to anybody who's an old wife, but I think it is a Wall Street construct. It is merely because the IWM is getting more inflows than the SPY. That's why the Russell 2000 is doing better. Nearly one third of the companies in the Russell do not make money. So I don't believe that any big cap manager is selling Facebook, Google, what have you, in order to buy small cap stocks, because there's just not enough cap to go around.
So, Chris, if you want to know where the bubble is in this bull market, it is in passive index funds. Money is going in. It is a pure example of money chasing an asset without regard to its price. Worse, it is money that thinks it is diversified when, in fact, it is highly concentrated in a handful of stocks.
Now, Jim, I want to move on to a second theme that you've articulated, but also related to the passive bubble theme. That's the theme of financial concentration.
This is one that is an accelerating theme, which is concentration. In the last crisis, Chris, we were worried about too big to fail. We saw big banks, we saw Lehman Brothers go under, Bear Stearns go under, AIG, Merrill Lynch. And we passed all kinds of legislation with Dodd-Frank because we were worried that these institutions would get so big, they would take down the system. In this bull market, the big got even bigger. And let me just explain and give some examples. If you look at derivatives today, there's about $200 trillion in derivatives, and just four banks make up 94% of the ownership of those derivatives. JP Morgan is at the top with $75 trillion. Next to JP Morgan is Citibank with $48 trillion, Goldman Sachs with $41 trillion, and Bank of America with $23 trillion. So four banks out of the hundreds of thousands of banks in this country, when it comes to derivatives, they control 94% of a $200 trillion market. The same banks, along with Wells Fargo, control close to 32% of the nation's bank deposits. And let me give you an example of how this has actually steepened and gotten more concentrated. Since 2008 financial crisis, three banks, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, have added more than $2.4 trillion in domestic deposits over the last decade, an increase of 180%. Before the crisis, they held 20% of the nation's country's deposit. Today, they hold $3.8 trillion, or roughly 32% of all the deposits in this country are held with just three banks. And it's not just banking. If we look at the financial markets, just three companies, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, control 88% of the S&P 500 companies. So when it comes time to sell, this is the big question. Who are these guys going to sell to? In the end, it is my belief the only buyer left large enough to absorb any selling that would ensue as a result of a financial panic is going to be the Fed. Just as they bought bonds in the last crisis, they could end up buying stocks in the next crisis. Let me give you some more concentration. Let's take a look at financial assets like stocks and bonds. Currently, there's roughly about $19 trillion in mutual funds. Of that amount, $11 trillion is held by just 10 companies. At the very top, or at the bottom, is PIMCO. They have $356 billion. Franklin has $411 billion. Dimensional Funds, $417 billion. Nuveen, roughly about $450 billion. BlackRock, $543 billion. J.P. Morgan, $567 billion. And T. Rowe Price, $635 billion. But here's where the biggies come in. In the number three spot, Capital Preservation or Capital Research, they control about 1.75 of a trillion dollars. Fidelity, 2.1 trillion. Vanguard, almost 4 trillion. So if you take Capital Research, Fidelity, and Vanguard, they control nearly 8 trillion of a 19 trillion market. In other words, they control just three companies, 40% of the assets. You throw in Schwab, and you're talking about four entities that control over 60% of the assets. Whether it's derivatives, bank deposits, financial assets, you have them all held by a handful of companies that really control the financial system. So consequently, as a result of the financial crisis, the big became monolithic financial structures. Does anyone listening to this program really believe the government would let any of these institutions fail? I mean, this is one of the things that really surprised me in the last crisis, is when it got to the point of saving Lehman, why the Fed or the government did not step in, because Lehman was tied to everybody. And as soon as they let Lehman go, what did we have? Merrill Lynch went, AIG went, a whole host of financial institutions went under, and they had to spend the next 9 months to the tune of almost $9 trillion of backstopping the market. There's no way, Chris, as big as these institutions are today, they would either let them fail or let them get in a position where they were unable to sell.
Jim, you did a program on this several years ago called Land of the Giants. So what we'll do for our listeners, we'll provide links on the website, financialsense.com, along with the themes that we've touched upon today and which have been articulated here over the last 18 months.
You know, it's just, Chris, if I was to say it was just in the financial sector, it'd be one thing. But we've seen financial concentration is reflected throughout our economy. We are moving to a system of monopolies and oligopolies where just a handful of companies dominate a sector. If you're thinking, and let me just give you some prime examples of this. If you're thinking of airlines, there's just mainly four: American, Delta, United, and Southwest. If you are thinking of airplane manufacturers, there's basically two. It's Boeing and Airbus. If you're talking about car companies in the United States, there's three, but you're really down to talking about two: GM and Ford. If you want to talk about transportation, well, there's two companies, UPS and FedEx. If you're talking about the largest distributors of commodities and grains in the world, there's two companies, Bunge and Archer Daniels Midland. The number of companies is shrinking and they're getting gobbled up. Merger and activity this year will set an all-time record. The highest activity in M&A occurred in the year 2000. It was roughly about $1.7 trillion. We surpassed over $1 trillion or $2 trillion by the time we got to June of this year. So, Chris, this year we could see $3 trillion of M&A activity. And let me give you an example of what this means for investors and the markets, because you keep hearing about stock buybacks. What does that mean? They're shrinking the float of stocks that are out there. When you hear me talk about M&A, that means companies in competition are getting eliminated. And to put this in perspective, between 1996 and 2016, over one half of all the public companies in the market have disappeared in the last 20 years, from nearly 7,300 companies to just 3,600 companies and less, and shrinking by the week. There's no longer a Wilshire 5,000. Today, there are more funds and ETFs than there are stocks to invest in. So the trend is companies are getting larger and older. And one reason you are seeing higher profit margins is there's fewer companies. And what does that mean? There's less competition in the industry. So the net is higher industrial concentration, which leads to higher profits, which are at a record, higher prices for consumers, fewer startups, lower productivity, lower wages, and greater inequality.
So the takeaway here is that we're seeing financial concentration as well as industrial concentration. So in essence, the big just keep getting bigger. The best example of that is what we discussed earlier with companies like Apple, Amazon, and soon Alphabet becoming trillion-dollar companies whose market capitalization is larger than many countries' GDP. And that leads me to our next theme of liquidity.
Well, you know, if you take the two topics that we talked about, number one, the index bubble, and number two, financial concentration, this leads to the next theme. When you have just a few hands that own the market, it creates a liquidity problem, because who do you sell to when it comes to, let's say, you own the market, or let's say when investors panic and press the sell button? Just as indexing has pushed up the value of stocks like Amazon, the FANG stocks, it can also work in reverse. And this is one of the things that people don't realize in index funds. They think, oh, I'm in an index fund, I'm in the S&P, or I'm in a index ETF, and you think, I'm well diversified. What you don't understand is the bulk of the market cap of that index is concentrated in a handful of stocks. And so it can work in reverse on the downside, just as all that money that pours into an index fund that forces that manager to go out and buy those stocks, regardless of the fundamentals or the price, it also happens in reverse. And let me give you an example, a recent one. When you saw, for example, Facebook in a single day drop from $217 a share to $176 a share in a single day, a 20% drop in just one day. And that's just one stock.
So when you talk about liquidity, the one obvious point that comes to mind is when just a handful of financial institutions control the market, who steps in and becomes the buyer when they need to sell? I don't think John Q. Public is going to be the one buying Amazon at $2,000 when the index funds and ETFs need to sell.
And there is the heart of the problem, Chris, because in today's market, which are dominated by passive funds and algo trading, which accounts for roughly about 90% of daily trading, the algo traders can disappear at a time when index funds need to sell. So the result is you see these big gaps in stocks, and that's what happened to Facebook. One day it closed at 2017, the next day it opened up at 174. So a drop of 20% at the opening bell. So the result is you are more likely to see these kind of flash crashes. We've seen them periodically. We saw them in 2010. We saw that roughly in the first week of February this year when the S&P gave back 12% in 6 days. We saw that also in the first part of 2016 where there was relentless selling every single week for the first 6 weeks of the year. It looked like we were heading into a meltdown. which caused the Fed to kind of retract and pull back on its plans to raise interest rates three times that year. So the combination of what we see today, computerized trading, along with passive index investing, are setting up the ideal market environment for what I call violent moves in the equity markets. We've already seen it, as I mentioned. We saw it, for example, in the selling in 2016. We saw it in the 1,600-point drop in February this year. And so everything is in place. The concentration is there. The market conditions are ripe. So, you know, this is one of the things that perplexed a lot of people, and this was a subject at the Fed's conclave in August, is this financial concentration. What do you do when you just have a handful of players that really control the market? What happens when they all have to sell at the same time? Who's going to be the buyer on the other side? And the other thing that we're seeing is you can see these, what I call fast and furious, where these corrections, Facebook is a prime example of this, is where you can see a 20% correction. So let's say you own Facebook. It was at 2017 on July 25th, and you're thinking, you know, this thing has really had a nice run. I think I'm going to unload the next day. Well, guess what? The market opens up the next day and you're down 20% at the opening bell. What do you do? Imagine what it'd be like in a market panic.
Well, Jim, I want to put the brakes on here for a minute because I don't think listeners may fully comprehend the implications of what you're saying here, of exactly what this toxic combination of computerized trading and passive investing would look like.
Let's take an example of how stocks trade with a real-life example from the flash crash of 2010. There was a stock, well-known Dow stock, Procter & Gamble, very stable, large market cap. It opened that day at $48 a share. Now, what typically happens in market trading, you have, let's say, market prices are at $48 a share. Now, you may have bids for Procter & Gamble that go, somebody might want to buy Procter & Gamble at $47, somebody might want to buy it at $46.50, maybe somebody else at $45, $44. Usually you see the bids go down between 10, maybe 15% below where the markets or where the stock is trading in the current market. Once you get past that 15% below where the stock is trading, there's usually no bids there because if the stock is trading at, let's just make this mathematically simple. If a stock is trading at 100 and you may have bids going down to 90, maybe down to 80, but that's it. Who's going to be putting in a bid for a stock at 70 when the stock is at 100? So here's what happens. You get these flash crashes and all of a sudden it opens up and everybody sells at one fell swoop. And this is accelerated with algo trading, which, you know, you're talking about split second, nanosecond selling. And so you have a day like we did with Facebook on July 25th, it closed at 2017. The next day it opens up at 174. So it's immediately down 20% or $44 at the open. So you sort of get an idea of the magnitude and speed at which this can happen. So we already have the setup for this to happen again, but probably more violent. Now remember, all of this is happening in a recovering economy in a booming stock market. We all know what happens when things change. When the economy moves into recession, the stock market will be moving into a bear market long before the recession hits. So right now, things can happen quicker with steeper declines, and especially at some point, we will be in another recession. The government, the Fed, have not repealed the business cycle, and with that recession, we will be in another bear market in stocks.
Well, I appreciate that example, Jim. I think that really does bring it home. Now, there's a question that comes to mind. If nearly 50% of the market is invested in passive index funds and the bulk of stocks are with just a handful of financial institutions, what happens when investors panic and it comes time to sell?
Well, I mean, there's probably one of three outcomes. Number one, you could get a severe flash crash where the markets are down 15 to 20%. Think of what we saw in the first week of February this year. Think of the flash crash of 2010. Or number two, overwhelming selling takes place like we did in 1987 when the Dow was down 23% in a single day. And simply the market triggers go off and they just shut down the exchanges. Or number three, if the selling persists for a long period of time or extended period of time, I predict you'll see the Fed step in and buy stocks. And don't think this can happen. The Bank of Japan has already done this. So the precedent, Chris, has already been set. So three things are likely to happen. Flash crash, they shut the market down, or if the selling continues, eventually the Fed comes in and becomes the buyer of last resort. That is probably going to be a more likely outcome because simply right now there's just too much financial concentration. When the markets are controlled, when you have three companies control nearly 90% of the S&P, the other 10% of the market is unable to buy.
Okay, so given your view of economic stimulus being as massive as it is, and another $500 billion coming next year, you don't see a recession or bear market coming, at least until late 2019 or 2020, with continuous rate hikes. Now, you do see the markets becoming more volatile. So what should investors do to protect themselves?
I mean, everyone should have an exit plan. And I don't believe at this point you should be 100% invested in stocks, in my opinion. We like short-term bonds, and we like short-term sovereign bonds, especially because they're very liquid. You should also look at asset rotation. If you're into some very high-flying areas of the market, you might want to consider scaling back and getting a little bit more defensive. You've heard a lot of my guests, including Basil Chapman, today when I ask them, as I do with all my technicians, I go, given these things that we're seeing right now, what would you be doing? You know, Chris, I have yet to hear one of them say, hey, go for it. Put all the chips on the table and man, let's go for it and make it big. They're all urging a little bit of caution, all urging maybe having a little bit of cash reserves. They're all urging to have something outside of being 100% invested in stocks. So if you do own stocks, you want to own high-quality companies you can hold on to with good dividends in case of a sudden downdraft. And this brings me back to a comment with my interview with Ralph Ancampora. And he's at that point, and his wife was very, very successful Wall Street advisor. And she really emphasized dividends and high-quality dividend-paying stocks. And Ralph, being the technician, and he told the story, he said, you know, he went to his wife and he said, you know, I just, the charts are telling me to sell. And she said, Ralph, we're in this for the long run. A lot of the experts we have on this program, and including ourselves, we're not smart enough to tell you the exact timing. What will be the event? When will we be in a recession? When the flash crash is going to occur? You heard John Roque as we played that. He says, I just hope I'm smart enough to see that there's trouble coming. So we want to alert you to the dangers that are lurking out there, because when things are going well, the economy right now is growing at 4%. The unemployment rate will probably get down to 3.5%. We have stimulus coming into the economy this year. Next year, we have $500 trillion of spending and tax cuts coming into the market. So that's why when we did the show a while back, we said, we don't see a recession or bear market coming anytime soon. Could be maybe late 2019, maybe 2020. So, but when it does, it's not going to be gradual. And it'll occur, or let's say occur over a long period of time, like from 2007 to March of 2009. This time around, you know, the first jump down is likely to be as much as 20%. And it'll be more like fast and furious than gradual. So you need to be positioned in advance. And I always like to give the analogy of weather because, well, I'm a sailor, so it just appeals to me. And I use this analogy. You are sitting on the shore right now in Florida. You're looking across the bay. It's nice. The waters are calm. It's a nice, balmy summer day. But about 1,000 miles away from you, off the west side of Africa, there is a weather front that's building. And that's what I'm trying to basically tell people now, and it's what a lot of our experts have said. There's a weather front building. Right now, it's 1,000 miles offshore, but it's building. We don't know where it'll, how strong it'll be, where it'll hit, when it will hit. But as it builds up, you know what people do along the coast. They start boarding up their windows and houses, and they take preparations because they don't know how severe the storm will be. They don't know if it'll be a direct hit, if it'll pass it by, or whether they'll dodge a bullet. And that's simply what you don't know as an investor.
Well, we'll continue to elaborate on these themes in weeks ahead, as they'll be the basis of our upcoming fall wealth preservation conference. So stay tuned. Coming up when we come back from the break, we'll discuss a little more in depth the passive index fund investing, also a lot of asset reshuffling, as well as changes in the tech sector. We're calling it Shake, Rattle, and Reshuffle. Stay tuned for the second part of The Big Picture.
He wrote the article Trains, Planes, and Dotcoms, detailing the euphoria in technology stocks and the bubble it represented 3 months before the peak in the NASDAQ. He wrote the article The Next Big Thing in April of 2002, pointing out the crossroads of a bear market fueled by monetary expansion, only to birth the next bull market in commodities. He wrote yet another prescient article in December of 2006 called The Next Rogue Wave, detailing the out-of-control credit expansion in developed economies a year before the global financial crisis began. You may know him from his weekly financial podcast, The Financial Sense NewsHour. Jim Poplava has been educating the public on personal finances, investing, and the financial markets for over 30 years. He closed off his seminars to the public to focus only on his clients. Now, for the first time since the 90s, he is opening up his wealth of knowledge on the markets back to the public and invites you to a seminar, the Financial Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference, this October at the Hilton Del Mar. This is one seminar you won't want to miss. Call 888-486-3939 for more information or tune in now to his podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour, on iTunes and iHeartMedia to hear what he's saying now.
Financial Sense Wealth Management would like to invite all of our listeners to join us this year at the Hilton San Diego Del Mar Hotel, Saturday, October 27th, for our annual Financial Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference. Seats are limited, and all attendees receive a complimentary discount at the Hilton San Diego Del Mar Hotel by calling us today at 858-487-3939. Once again, seats are limited, so call today, 858-487-3939, for this special once-a-year event.
Well, just as the new tax laws have shaken things up on the economic front and in the markets this year, another major change is coming to the markets this month. And it isn't the next Fed rate hike. There's a major change that's going to have a major impact on investing, and it will be unprecedented. And sector investing will not be the same. This could be the kind of event that triggers a flash crash, or it could just be a mild event. We simply won't know until it occurs. S&P and MSCI are overhauling their global industry classification system known as GICS, a widely used system of classification that carves up the stock market into sectors, industry groups, industries, and sub-industries. In fact, Ryan Poplava touched on this last week in his market wrap. Now, we're going to go more in depth on this on The Big Picture.
And Chris, the reason this change is important, it determines what stocks go into various sector funds or ETFs. So it's going to generate a lot of asset reshuffling. The biggest change is coming to a new sector called the communications sector. It's going to replace telecommunications when you think of things like AT&T or Verizon. The telecommunications sector is actually going to become extinct. The new sector is going to cherry-pick stocks from the tech sector, consumer discretionary, as well as the telecom sector. Now, the new sector will be huge. And when I say huge, it'll become the fourth largest sector for investing. Number one is technology. Number two is healthcare. And number three is financials. The new communication sector will become number four. Now, the S&P plans to reconstitute its indexes after the market closes on September 28th. MSCI is going to change their indexes, and that will go into effect December 2nd. So mark those 2 days on your calendar. After Friday's market close, they're going to reconstitute all these indexes. So you better mark your calendar of what October 1st, Monday, is going to look like when it opens up and trading. Now, let me just go here to December when MSCI will change their index. They will change that on, December 3rd, which will be a Monday. So mark December 4th is a key date. That's when MSCI will change their global indexes as well. So this is, Chris, this is going to be a big thing. And we simply, at this point, do not know what this is going to look like.
Now, on the surface, Jim, that just doesn't seem like a big deal. But I have a feeling that you see much broader implications.
Well, this heightens my passive index theme, as some sectors will become more heavily concentrated in just a few big names, like Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Alphabet, which will become the heavyweights within the new communication sector service. So the sector will become more highly concentrated, and this move and reclassification will ripple across the markets, as this will trigger a substantial migration of stocks. So if you're an index manager and the stocks in your index are no longer part of your index, what do you have to do? You have to get rid of those index or stocks because they're no longer part of your mandate for your index. So you got to sell them. If Alphabet isn't in your index or Amazon isn't in your index, it's going to the new communications index, you're going to have to sell. So what you just hope is there's going to be somebody on the other end on the communication service side that will be buying the stocks that you have to dump. So this is much, much bigger, and it's going to be more highly concentrated, and this is just going to ripple across all the sectors. It's not just communications sector that is changing. They're going to reweight technology. They're going to reweight, change consumer discretionary. Some of these indexes, if you thought they were highly concentrated now, they're going to become even more highly concentrated in the future. So it's not just going to be Apple and Amazon that are trillion-dollar companies. You could see Google behind it, behind Google, Microsoft, and several others. Chris, we're going to have a handful of stocks whose market cap is bigger than some of our biggest industrial countries in the world.
Well, as you were looking at your calendar, Jim, I circled December 3rd on mine as when that's going to go into effect. And so the sector becomes more concentrated, obviously, on that day. But what are the investment implications of these changes for investors?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at how the financial industry is run today, investment advisors, investment strategists are always making sector recommendations. They might say, all right, we're late in the business cycle. We're recommending you get out of this sector, get into this sector. Or maybe hedge funds will use sectors to bet or place hedges on a position. Active managers will use sectors as sort of guidelines to benchmark their portfolios. So if you are being tracked against a particular benchmark, you're going to sort of use that as your guidepost, and you're going to try to mirror that index in some way so you're keeping up with the index. So as the business cycle ages or sectors become, let's say, overextended, it's going to generate asset shifts. So this change will have broad implications because they're sort of going to take and create one whole new sector by cherry picking from some of the best sectors and the best stocks, put them all on this new sector, and then they're also going to change the sectors that they just took those stocks from. They're going to look much different. So, Chris, there is going to be a lot of reshuffling that's going to take place on September 28th and on December 3rd.
Now, Jim, where do you see the biggest impact with all of this?
You know, probably the biggest change will be in the tech sector that now represents about 27% of the S&P 500. It's responsible, and this just goes to show you the magnitude of what this change might look like. The tech sector is responsible for half of the market's gains this year. And of course, the tech sector itself, most of the gains have come from these handful of stocks. So as a result of the reshuffle, the big stocks move out of the tech sector and over into the new communications sector. Stocks like Alphabet, Facebook, Activision, Twitter move to the communications sector, cutting the tech sector by almost 25%. Now, the tech sector, and here's another one that is going to be very important as we go into the late stages of a business cycle. The tech sector is going to become more oriented towards chip makers, hardware, software. That'll include Apple and Microsoft and Intel. So the tech sector could become more cyclical and subject to the whims of the economy. Now, Apple will still make up about 20% of the tech sector, so tech will become more industrial. The net of all of this is the tech sector profile is going to shrink, and it's going to be downsized. The hot new sector will be the communications service sector. That's where you're going to find the high growth companies, the FANGs, the companies that have had the highest growth rate in these last couple of years. Now, here's the other thing that's also going to change in the communications sector. In addition to some of these high flyers, half will come from tech. The other half consists of media companies and telecom companies like, for example, CBS, Comcast, Netflix, and the old stalwarts such as Verizon and AT&T. So even telephone and Verizon have moved into the media sector with AT&T buying Time Warner and Verizon buying Yahoo. There's also another change that's going to be coming to consumer discretionary. It's going to be losing Disney, Netflix, Comcast, and Fox, which are all heading over to the communications sector. So discretion or consumer discretionary is really going to be all about Amazon. But Amazon's major profits, and here's the one, come mainly from cloud services, not retail.
Well, the gist of all this is major changes are coming to passive index investing, and this may just be the kind of event that ushers in autumn volatility. We'll just have to wait and see. So as we end the week, Jim, anything that we should be focusing our attention on right now?
You know, Chris, the two main events this month are probably going to be the upcoming Fed meeting. It's, 95% probability they'll raise interest rates a quarter of a point. You know, the markets will be watching what the Fed says. Any indications? Do they change the dot plot? There will be a press conference accompanying this meeting. And, everybody's going to look at it. Will they go the fourth time in December, as the markets are widely anticipating? So that's one event. And the other event is what we just discussed, the asset shuffle that will take place at the end of the month. So you're going to have to wait to October 1st to see how all this asset reshuffling will play itself out in the market. So those are the two biggies. And probably in the last part of the September, we should get pre-announcements on Q3 earnings. They're expected to be very robust, just as Q1 and Q2 earnings are going to be. So I don't think that you're going to see any major surprises there. So the big ones for September, asset reshuffling with the S&P indexes and the Fed rate hike that is widely expected to come this month. So those are the big events. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.